everybody. Welcome back to my channel. Thanks so much for tuning in. My name is Dana Trupiana, and I cover infamous gangsters every week in a true crime-like format. My show, Mob Times, comes out every Tuesday. Please go ahead and turn your notifications on for my channel so that you can get notified when my video comes out, because I can't give you a time that my videos come out. I don't know. I'm a whole mess. Nobody knows what time of the day on Tuesday that these videos are going to come out. We just hope they come out on Tuesday. So, how was everybody's week? Mine has been pretty uneventful. I have this cold that I am convinced that I'm going to have for the rest of my life. You're going to hear me throughout the episode being worse and better and worse and better as far as being stuffed up and like the way that my voice sounds. I legit went back and re-recorded the intro to this video because I sounded so bad the first time I recorded it. So if I go from normal to really stuffy to normal again, that's why. I timed this cold out and it started on January 5th. It is now February 20th. That is over a month and a half, and I am goddamn sick of being sick. I sound like a moron 90% of the time, I can't breathe, and like, yeah, okay, a huge chunk of that is because I have a big tumor in my nose, so one of my nostrils is completely impassable almost all of the time. But another huge chunk of that is because of this sickness that just will not go away. It's lingering and it's trying to ruin my life and I just want to feel better. Like right now, I can breathe a little bit, but just wait a minute until you hear what I sound like in 1 minute. So last week, we really didn't get a chance to talk about Angelo all that much. And we really just spent most of the episode reviewing his father. So we're going to go ahead and get into this episode. We're not going to do a long intro. And hopefully we'll be able to get through a decent chunk of information for Angelo this week. When we left off, Big Joe Lunardo had just been killed by one of his all-time best friends, Black Sam Todaro. In the days, weeks, months, and years after Big Joe was killed, who was in control of Cleveland kind of felt like it was up in the air, and it felt like it wasn't ever really going to get figured out. Nobody had any idea who the real leader of the Cleveland Mafia was. After Big Joe died, Frank Milano stepped up and he became the boss of the Mayfield Road Mob. Did that mean that Milano was the leader of the Cleveland Mob? Nobody really knew. Joe Pirello crowned himself the new corn sugar baron and he led the Pirello family. Was he the leader? Nobody really had any idea. Nothing was ever cemented and they all just thought that they were the ones that were leading the Cleveland Mafia. Joe Pirello, at that point, decided that he was going to do something about that. Now, remember, at this time, Big Angelo's father and uncle had just been killed. Big Joe was Big Ange's father, and John Lunardo, who died with Big Joe, was his uncle. But he's around 17 years old at the time. He's really not in a position where he can be getting into a high-level conversation about who's going to be the new leader of the mafia or trying to sway things towards the MRM or the Pirellos. Either way, he's 17 years old. He really can't do absolutely anything about this entire situation. Which definitely sucks because even though he's 17 years old, this boy's been groomed since he was a little child on mafia relations and how to be in the mafia. So regardless of the fact that he's 17 years old, he still knows what he's doing and he's probably more qualified to be the mafia leader than a lot of the guys in the Cleveland Mafia. So it's a crappy kind of situation and time for Angelo right now. At this point, he's really just viewed as a kid. Think about like the beginning of Goodfellas, in the beginning where he shows up at home in a suit and his mom cries because he looks like a gangster. That's what's going on right now. That's Angelo at this point. But at the end of the day, no matter how old he is, this boy is still living every single day in the mafia, in the life, knowing that his father and his uncle had just been taken out and there's really nothing he can do about it. And it's just sad. It's a rough situation. This poor boy's entire life is in shambles right now. And not only that, the guys that conspired to kill his father and his uncle are out there living life right now, leading mafia groups. As someone who knows who murdered somebody very close to me, and I know he's out there every day living his best life and facing absolutely no retribution for it, trust me when I tell you that every single day that goes by, the anger, the resentment, and the pain that Angelo is facing right now is just growing. It's not getting any better. So anyways, Joe Perrello has now decided that he wants to do something about the fact that there is no established mafia boss of Cleveland. So he decides that he's going to hold a summit. Now, remember, this is before the New York families had been set up. This is before the Casella-Morisi War. This is before Salvatore Maranzano or Lucky Luciano or whoever you want to give credit to officially set up any mafia family, the Five Families, New York Families, Chicago, Cleveland. None of that has officially been set up. There's no official Five Families. There's no official ruling body of the mafia. There's nothing. So when Joe Perrello calls a meeting at the Statler Hotel in Cleveland and puts the entire thing together with Sam Tolocco, all of the high-level mafia bosses come together in one place for the first time in recorded American history to have a summit and try to work things out. He plans this summit for December 5th, 1928. Before we start to go over the summit, let's take a quick look at 1929 and what's going on at that time. First off, the position of Capo di Tutti Capi still exists, and it would still exist until Lucky Luciano would just throw the entire position out after he took out Salvatore Maranzano in 1931, who was kind of the last person who would officially hold that title. I've heard people call Carlo Gambino the Capo di Tutti Capi. I've heard a lot of people take the title, but Maranzano seems to be the last one to officially hold that title. Lucky Luciano pretty much turned around and he was like, listen, I don't want that title to exist anymore. I could take it. Nobody would fight me on it, but then people would want to kill me to get the title. So instead of taking it and holding it and having everybody want to kill me for it, we're going to get rid of the title. We're going to establish the commission and there's going to be a whole ruling body. We've gone over that a million times in the Maranzano video, in the Lucky Luciano video, all the videos. We've gone over it, but just remember, the Capo di Tutti Capi position, it does officially exist as of right now in 1928. Currently, Joe Masseria is holding that title after he took out Salvatore D'Aquila on October 10th, 1928. And again, this is happening in December. So we've got one Masseria Capo di Tutti Capi in December of 1928. But I mean, he's been a boss in the mafia for a very long time. So like, yeah, he just took that title, but he is by no means like a newcomer. Once again, I'm going to restate this because this has never been written anywhere, or if it has been written somewhere, I've never stumbled on it. And I have looked for it. So I'm kind of pretty confident in saying that I don't think it's written anywhere. But I am 100% convinced, and you cannot convince me otherwise, that Joe Masseria was behind the Perrello brothers going out on their own and leaving Big Joe's operation. So therefore, because of that, I am personally fully convinced that the Perellos have the backing of Masseria. And I'm also 100% convinced that Angelo Linardo knows that Masseria is behind this. So he knows that Masseria is behind the Perellos who just took out his father. So I don't know. I don't know why I feel so bad for Angelo in this little time period. This poor 17 to 18 year old kid is just out there all alone in the world. The whole world is against him. And I don't know. I just really want to give him a hug. I feel so bad for him in this spot. Like, you got the most powerful gangster in the world. He's the Capo di Tutti Capi. And he is behind the Perellos who just took out your father. Like, it just sucks. It sucks to be Angelo right now. I feel for him. So let's talk about the 1928 Hotel Statler Mafia Conference. Honestly, this conference sounds like it went down very similar to the Appalachian Conference. It was a mess. A lot of people got arrested. The meeting itself really didn't even get a chance to take off. Like, it sounds very eerily similar to the Appalachian Conference. So is this the first meeting of the mafia ever? No, absolutely not. Because, like, if you think about it, there really isn't even a mafia yet. So really all this is a meeting of the highest ranking gangsters in the underworld in their respective cities. Since there really isn't even a mafia yet, I guess you can consider the gangsters and the bootleggers the mafia. And bootleggers would regularly meet up to talk shop. There would regularly be summits and very important gangsters that would meet up. But it seems like this is the first meeting to group together so many high-ranking gangsters from such a far-reaching area. We've got men from Buffalo, New York. And I specify Buffalo because that shit is like Canada adjacent. It is so much further north than New York City. It took me about 12 hours to drive to Spencerport the last time I had to drive there. And Spencerport is very close to Buffalo, I believe. So saying Buffalo and New York City, that's saying two totally different things. And if you don't know that there's a difference between New York, New York City, and Long Island, and New York upstate, fight me. I don't know what to tell you. So we've got guys that are from as far north as Buffalo, New York, and as far south as Tampa, Florida. Of course, we've got our New York City, New Jersey heavyweights, but we've also got a bunch of guys from Chicago, Indiana, and St. Louis. And that's just the boys that got caught. We don't even know how many people were there that didn't get caught and where they could have been from. So Joe Perrello holds this meeting and he invites gangsters from all over the country, right? He's like, hey, we've had a lot of bodies dropping in Cleveland lately, and I also know that you guys got some beef going on around you. Maybe this little meeting that we have can smooth over everything for everyone everywhere. In his head, he is rubbing his little palms together because the whole point is that he's trying to be officially recognized as the boss of Cleveland. This is all just one big scam, but he does have a point. There has been a lot of change in the underworld recently, so a meeting wouldn't really be the worst thing in the world. As I said before, Di Aquila had recently been killed, leaving the position of Capo di Tutti Capi open in New York, and Joe Masseria snagged that up real quick. But that's something that hasn't officially been recognized yet. As much as everybody knows that that's the case, it hasn't been officially recognized. It hasn't been officially put on the books. Maybe this could be the perfect place to officially announce that to the entire underworld. Another outstanding issue that hasn't been officially and totally handled yet is the killing of Tony Lombardo, the Union Siciliana president. The Union Siciliana is pretty much just a front for the mafia back then. Like, if you were the president of the Union Siciliana, you were the Capo di Tutti Capi, the big boss of the Sicilian faction, which is the faction that survives today. If you watch my Giuseppe Gallucci video, there was other factions back then, but now the mafia that you know, that's the Sicilian mafia. Lombardo, who was a close personal friend of Al Capone, and was also the leader of the Union Siciliana, was mowed down with two of his bodyguards at the corner of Madison and Dearborn Streets, some of the busiest streets in the world, in Chicago at 4:30 in the afternoon on September 7th, 1928. Looking at pictures of his funeral is absolutely wild. This funeral definitely rivaled Big Joe in numbers and in opulence. So we've got Di Aquila down in New York City. We've got Lombardo that went down in Chicago. We've got Big Joe that went down in Cleveland. Boys, we have a lot to talk about. Now, since Cleveland is just currently a powder keg that's legit about to explode, and it just so happens to be smack dab in the middle of New York, Michigan, Illinois, and Missouri, it seems like the logical place to hold the summit. The only people that this placement is really gonna screw over is the people in Florida, but I mean, they're from Florida, who really cares? There were some serious heavyweights that attended this conference, and these are the guys that were arrested, because again, we have no idea who ended up going there but didn't get arrested. But these are the guys that did get arrested. We got Salvatore Sam DiCarlo from Buffalo. We got Ignazio Italiano and Giuseppe Joe Vaglica from Tampa, Florida. We got Paul Palazzola from Gary, Indiana. From the New York City, New Jersey area, we've got Emmanuel Camerata, Vincent Mangano, Giuseppe Magliocco, Giuseppe Joe Perfacci, Giuseppe Trina, Andrew Lombardino, Salvatore Lombardino, Giuseppe Palermo, and Michael Russo. Now, again, this is kind of proof that not everybody that attended was arrested, because the only person that was arrested from Cleveland was Sam Tolocco. And since Perrello was the one that actually called the meeting, and they called the meeting to work out the beef between the Perrello gang and the Mayfield Road mob, which is Frank Milano, you would assume that these guys would attend the meeting. We're also assuming that Joe Masseria should have been there, so I don't really know why those guys weren't arrested. They probably were there and just escaped being arrested. In Chicago, we've got Frank Allo, Tony Bella, Giuseppe Giunta, James Intravia, Pasquale Lollardo, Sam Oliveri, and Giuseppe Saccio. And last but not least, we've got St. Louis being represented by Giovanni Mirabella and Caligero Sam Filippo. And listen, okay, I know English. That's it. I only know English. I don't know Italian. I do my very best to pronounce these guys' names as they are supposed to be pronounced in Italian, but I'm gonna mess them up every once in a while. I try. I really do. I even, like, double-check the pronunciation of a lot of these guys. I get made fun of for my pronunciation of things all the time because Americans are used to hearing Anastasia and not Anastasia, because Anastasia is how it's pronounced in Italian. So listen, I may have botched quite a few of those names. I'm very sorry if I did. I only know English. I'm doing my very best here. So all these guys get arrested. Sam Tolocco gets on the phone. He calls up Joe Perrello and he lets him know that they're all in jail. And then Perrello goes around and he raises the bail for all of these guys, which is no easy feat, because bail ends up being $200,000 to get all 22 of these guys out of jail. There was 23 guys that were arrested, but he can only get 22 of them out, and it's going to be 200 grand to get the 22 guys out that he can get out. And that seems like a shit ton of money for a whole bunch of guys that legit did nothing wrong. They were just at a place that the cops didn't like them being at. So $200,000 seems like a lot of money, right? Well, if it were today's money, that $200,000 bail would be about $3.6 million. So all of these guys are arrested the day of the meeting of December 5th, 1928. And Perrello had all of them out by the 7th. So less than two full days, they're in the jail. One of the dudes got jammed up because he had a murder warrant, so he couldn't get out of jail. He was going to be extradited. But everybody else spent less than 2 days in jail, so it wasn't the worst thing. At the end of the day, this Hotel Statler meeting is a whole-ass spectacle. Media was outside to capture each and every gangster being arrested and hauled off in handcuffs. 17 of them had guns on them when they were arrested, and even though they all had charges dropped because they were literally arrested for doing absolutely nothing, there was no reason for these guys to be arrested. But even though most of the charges would end up being dismissed, this was the first thing that would put a lot of these guys' name in national headlines for the very first time. And that is not something that most gangsters want. I mean, you've got your rogue John Gottis and Joseph Colombos, but for the most part, gangsters do not want their names in the headlines, so this isn't great. So Cleveland is not really looking good right now. Things are not going well on the streets. After Big Joe was hit, a war ensues and everybody can get it. While the police claim that Big Joe's death would end, not start, the Corn Sugar Wars, there is more people that are in a position of power dying in the next 5-year period than probably the 10 years before it. So there's a lot of people that are in powerful positions dying right now. Shortly after Big Joe's death, all of the Perrellos fall. Joe Perrello had taken over as the leader of the Cleveland Mafia, the Perrello faction, whatever, and he declared the Perrello family the actual Cleveland Mafia over the Mayfield Road Mob, even if he couldn't get the Mafia to confirm it at the Statler Hotel as he had hoped and prayed and dreamed would happen. He decided that this is now his call, and it's his town. And after Big Joe and John Leonardo were killed, he is now the Baron of Corn Sugar. Joe Perrella was taken out at a Venetian restaurant on July 5th, 1930. After he was killed, his brother Vincenzo took control of the Perrella faction. Vincenzo was killed 3 weeks later on July 26th, 1930. And it wasn't just the Perrella brothers that could get it after Big Joe died. The Perrella brothers, that's the jobs for the peripheral people. The person who actually pulled the trigger, who actually made the call that Big Joe be taken out, Black Sam Todaro, that was a job for Big Joe Leonardo's immediate family themselves. Now, remember when Big Joe wanted to take out Sam Todaro and everybody begged him not to? Nicola Gentile, he even gave him an ultimatum and said he wouldn't be his friend anymore if he did it. So I'm guessing that Big Joe Leonardo's immediate family, they're trying to get support to off this dude and they're just not getting it. Nobody is in their corner. Again, I say Big Ange, he's just kind of on his own right now. Since the immediate family couldn't gain support from the mafia, they decided that they were just going to take care of it themselves. They were going to take matters into their own hands, and Sam Todaro was not going to continue to live. In the days after Big Joe's death, Todaro was financially supporting Concetta. And that is just kind of following in the tradition that countless mafiosi before and after him had done with taking care of the family of the men that they whacked. Concetta would pull up in her maroon and black Chrysler Model 75 coupe, and Todaro would come out, he would hand her a thick envelope, and she would be able to pay the bills that week. That went on for almost 2 full years. Now, imagine being Concetta and Big Ange. Shortly before he died, Big Joe left Concetta. And Big Joe and Concetta had never officially been married. And Big Joe went and married a woman named Fanny. They were together for a really short amount of time and they had no kids together. But regardless, Fanny felt that when Big Joe died, because she had officially been married to him and Concetta never had been married to him, she should be entitled to all of Big Joe's wealth. When it came out that Big Joe's wealth would be handed over to Concetta and the kids that they had together, Fanny is not okay with this and she takes it to court. Her taking it to court made every dime of Big Joe Leonardo's wealth completely inaccessible. Because of this, now they have no access to any of the money that they had always had. Big Joe always took care of Concetta and the kids. But now Fanny's bringing it to court and they have no access to any money at all. The family has absolutely no choice but to take money from Sam Todaro to survive. But at the same time, they're taking this money knowing that it was Sam Todaro who made the call that Big Joe be murdered. So this goes on for 2 years, and 2 years later, there is still no resolution. There's still no money. Concetta is still taking money from Todaro, and she still has no access to any money other than the money that she's getting from Todaro. On June 11th, 1929, Concetta pulls up to collect her payment from Todaro, as she did every week or month. I'm not really sure how often she picked it up, but this is a very normal occurrence. She pulls up to get the envelope. Todaro runs the envelope out to her, and her son Angelo and her nephew Dominic Sosperato came along for the drive this week. When Todaro walked over to the car to give her the envelope that week, shots were heard and Todaro collapsed on the street, having been shot 5 times, and the Chrysler sped away. Now, 2 things I want to talk about really quick. First of all, I want to talk about the fact that Todaro is bringing an envelope to Concetta in the first place means that Big Joe's money is still all tied up in court. Concetta has no access to any money other than the money that Todaro is supplying to her, and she still feels so strongly about her ex-husband who left her to marry another woman before he died that she would take out her main source of income, Todaro, to avenge his death. I also do want to mention that a lot of people are up in the air about who actually fired those shots. A lot of people in Cleveland, they claim that it was Concetta that fired the shots that took out Todaro. When I watched Sugar Wars, Big Ange talked about how Dominic popped off one shot and it didn't hit him and he got scared. And Big Ange had to be the one to shoot all the shots, and he's the one that put the 5 shots into Todaro. But the word on the street is that it was Concetta, not Big Ange. But you also got to think that that's the way that the people of Cleveland talk after Big Ange is an informant and they don't really respect his legacy anymore. So up until then, everybody knew it was Big Ange. It was Big Ange. It wasn't Concetta. As badass as it is that Concetta was there and she was willing to make this happen, she probably put everything together. I don't believe for one second that it was Concetta that actually fired the shots that killed Todaro. I'm going with the theory that it was Big Ange that shot Todaro. But at the end of the day, I said this in my Big Joe episode, and I'll say it again, I think it is super dope that Concetta was willing to do this. Even though the relationship didn't work out between her and Leonardo, they got divorced a little while before he died. Even with that, even with Leonardo leaving her with all her kids, even with this battle going on in court for his money, and Fanny is probably in court saying, like, oh, Concetta doesn't deserve anything. Big Joe said that he hated her and that she was a gold digger. She shouldn't get a dime. Like, that's probably going on for the last 2 years. And even with all of that, Concetta still is like, okay, yeah, I'm supported by Todaro. That's the only source of income that I have right now. Big Joe left me before he died. He left me alone with all these kids. Even so, I am not letting his murder go unpunished, and I will take out Sam Todaro if nobody else will. And that right there is a ride or die bitch. I love Concetta. Angelo Sciatta, Todaro's brother-in-law, actually saw the shooting happen. And he told the cops who was in the car, which is wild because you would assume when he's hanging out at a mafia location that he's probably in the mafia. But no, this man sung like a canary and told the cops exactly who was in the car. When Concetta was arrested, she claimed she had no idea what happened. She wasn't there. She knew absolutely nothing. She doesn't even know if she was in Cleveland at that time. Like, she knows nothing. Cops were able to find Concetta pretty easily, but they could not locate Angelo or Dominic. Angelo and his cousin Dominic went into hiding for several months, and they were said to be in Chicago, thanks to Al Capone, a friend of the Leonardos. All three were indicted on first-degree murder charges. Something super interesting about this is that this would make Concetta the first woman to ever be indicted for capital murder charges in America. While they were on the run, Big Ange and Dominic go to Chicago. And while they're in Chicago, Capone is trying to be accommodating. He's trying to be as hospitable as he can. But this is also around the time that shit starts going down for Capone. So Leonardo and Dominic, they can't spend the entire time that they're on the run in Chicago. After a while, they headed to California so that they could hide out with Angelo's uncle Dominic. Now, this Dominic had fled Cleveland in 1921 after he was hit with a charge for murder and payroll robbery. So what does he do? He just picks up and moves to California. No big deal. What a time to be alive that moving to another state in the same country will get you away from a murder charge. This is the Dominic that we're going to talk about a little later that dies on the operating table. And Big Ange is going to go on to kill the surgeon that operated on him, who also just so happened to be the former boss of the Cleveland Licatese faction mafia. You know, I've heard a lot that it's rumored that Capone had connections to Cleveland. Like, it's a big rumor, it's a big secret. But I think that this right here, the fact that out of everywhere that Big Ange could have gone while he was on the run, he went to Chicago to hang out with Capone, I think that's pretty solid evidence that there's a connection and there's a presence from Capone in Cleveland. Like, there's definitely a connection. I don't know why it's like a rumor or like a dirty little secret. Like, yes, of course there's a connection. Come on. So Concetta doesn't flee. She stands there, she gets arrested, and she stands trial. After an entire court battle where Concetta was once again the first woman to ever be charged with capital murder in America, the jury found Concetta not guilty. after that happened, Angelo and Dominic, they come out of the woodwork and they pop back up. You got to think that they're probably like, all right, they found her not guilty. There's no way they're going to find us guilty. By March of 1930, the probate court had resolved the lawsuit that had gone on between Concetta and Fanny, and they left all of Big Joe Lenardo's money to Concetta. Fanny continued to appeal the court's decision, but, I mean, good luck. The value of the estate skyrocketed downward after this big war over who would get the money. While they're in court and Fanny and Concetta are fighting over this estate, the estate is getting diminished. It's going down, down, down. On top of that, Concetta's defense against the murder charges was another huge hit to the estate. And now they have to take on the cost of the defense of Angelo and Dominic. And while they're at it, Angelo went and caught another charge for a concealed weapon. And the cost of all of that defense is getting charged to the estate. By the time she got her hands on the money, the estate was down to only $149,000. That might not sound like a lot of money, but in today's money, that would be about $2.7 million. So it is way down from where it once was, but this is not pocket change. It's a decent amount of money, though. But it's a whole lot less than when they started. Angelo and Dominic surrendered to authorities in February of 1930, and they both pled not guilty to murder one. Exactly 1 year after the crime occurred, both Angelo and Dominic were both found guilty of murder two, and both sentenced to life in prison. Now, let's stop here real quick and talk about the significance of this. Angelo is 19 years old. 19. And he has just been handed a life sentence. Can you freaking imagine? Like, I would die. I literally cannot think of a worst case scenario. There is no such thing. No thing could happen that would be scarier to me. Like, this is the absolute worst thing that could ever happen. Thank God that these boys come from a mafia family and they're not really all that scared of life in jail, because if that was me, there is no way I would make it a year in jail with a life sentence. Absolutely not. 19 years old, handed a life sentence in jail. I'm not making it a year. No, I'm not making it to 20 years old. Not gonna happen. Thankfully, Angelo is not me, and he and Dominic went on to appeal their case. In November of 1931, both men won their appeal because the witnesses were no longer witnesses and they were acquitted of the crime. They went from spending the rest of their lives in prison to walking away free men. In February of 1932, Rosario and Raymond Perello, along with their bodyguard, were murdered. These are the last two remaining Perello brothers out of the seven brothers that were in the game. All of the Perello brothers that were left had fled Cleveland and the others died. Now, that is why I had to go back around and go over the entire history of Big Joe Lenardo and let you guys know why that all went on. The fact that Rosario and Raymond were killed in 1932, only 5 years after Big Joe Lenardo was killed, and they were the last of the Perello faction, and Concetta is suspected of having been a part of this murder. That's all stemming from the history that I just brought you guys through. So I'm sorry for repeating information that I had already put out there in the Big Joe Lenardo case, but it had to be done because think about the significance of that. There was seven Perello brothers that were all in the mafia, high-ranking mafia members. And within 5 years, every single one of them were either dead or hightailed it out of Cleveland, the place that they had called home. So now, the big question in the air had never been answered. Even with the murder of the two Perello brothers, things are still up in the air in Cleveland. Nobody knows who the official mafia is in Cleveland. And I mean that to say, like, okay, let's say the New York families, they want to have a symposium. They want to have a new meeting instead of the one that went wrong at the Statler Hotel. Who would be invited? The leader of which gang? The Perello faction? The Mayfield Road mob? Who is the actual representante? People had gotten arrested way too fast at the Statler to fall victim to what Perello had actually planned for the symposium, actually cementing him and by extension, the Perrello family faction, whatever, as the official mafia group of Cleveland. That never happened because everybody got arrested. And the Perellos are not the only other Italian faction in Cleveland. There's plenty of them. So with all these big players in the mix, who were the guys that were actually tied to New York? Who were the Cleveland La Cosa Nostra? That question was answered in 1931 when Frank Milano went to New York and he joined the National Crime Syndicate. That cemented his position as the leader of the one and only true mafia family in Cleveland, the Mayfield Road Mob. The National Crime Syndicate, it's just pretty much the leaders of all of the strongest gangs. It was comprised of big shots like Lucky Luciano, Meyer Lansky, Al Capone, all of the most famous names that you've ever heard in organized crime. They're members of the National Crime Syndicate. And it's kind of like a national La Cosa Nostra because you got Meyer Lansky, Bugsy Siegel. These guys are very, very important guys, but they can't be in La Cosa Nostra. So they made a separate group, the National Crime Syndicate, and that's where all the gangsters went. Once Milano joins the National Crime Syndicate, he's officially given a seat on the commission, the ruling body of the American Mafia. And that's that. He's the leader of the Cleveland Mafia. The Mayfield Road Mob, they're so legit that they're even mentioned in The Godfather. The fact that Frank Milano was leading shit in Cleveland could not have been better for Big Ange. He had a really close relationship with Frank Milano. Big Ange's godfather was Frank Milano's brother, Anthony Milano. Frank Milano was clearly a really smart, well-liked man, and he did really well for himself. The fact that he was able to get the Mayfield Road Mob, let alone himself, not only into the National Crime Syndicate, but also a seat on the commission, that's a huge undertaking in itself. He ran the Mayfield Road Mob really well, and everybody liked him. I really don't see any bad things about Milano out there. Pretty smooth sailing. That was up until 1935, when he was hit with the same charge that Capone was hit, tax evasion. After he was indicted, he ran for Mexico, and Alfred Polizzi, the underboss of the Mayfield Road Mob, stepped up and became the leader of the Cleveland Mafia. I did mention Polizzi in part one, but we're going to go over him a lot more today. So now at this point, I do want to stop for a second and talk about the documentary Sugar Wars. Now, I mentioned Sugar Wars in part one, but Sugar Wars is a documentary that's written about the Leonardo family, the Cleveland Mafia. It's just, I guess it's centered around Big Ange. But while I was watching Sugar Wars, there was a few times that I was watching it and I was like, yeah, no, like, that's a lie. You have no idea what you're talking about. That's wrong. But I did tell you guys, like, that is a really good documentary. And that's because there was quite a few times that I was watching that I was like, huh, that's good to know. I did not know that. Honestly, I've done so much research on the Leonardo family, probably more than any other gangster that I've ever done research on. And that's saying a lot. I've looked more into the Leonardos than I have Lucky Luciano, and I could write a goddamn TED talk on Lucky Luciano. So I love stumbling on like, hey, I didn't know that, facts about the Leonardos. So Sugar Wars was awesome, regardless of the fact that there was a few things here and there that just like weren't correct. For the most part, amazing documentary. One of those things that I did not know, and it made everything click together in my head and make sense, was about Frank Milano. Because in all of my research on this case, I've always known that Frank Milano was charged with tax evasion, and he ended up fleeing, and that's how Alfred Polizzi took over. But I never really knew why he was charged with tax evasion. I just figured it was like, okay, the Cleveland police know that he's leading the Cleveland Mafia, so they're gonna come after him. Like, we know that the government went after Al Capone for tax evasion after the St. Valentine's Day massacre, and because he had become such, like, a known name in America that they really didn't have a choice but to go after him for something. They kind of got to the point where they were like, listen, if we can't take you down for the murderous shit that you're doing all over the place because we can't come up with proof, all the witnesses refuse to testify, we're just going to take you down for tax evasion because, honestly, it's virtually indefensible. But Milano, I really didn't know why they attacked him. But then I watched Sugar Wars and finally it clicked in my head. I figured it out. And I only watched Sugar Wars the other day, which is kind of crazy because in all the research that I've done, I've heard this documentary mentioned over and over and over again, but I never actually sat down and watched it. And then the other day I sit down and I'm like, all right, I just have to sit down and watch it and see what it says. I need to do it. Well, I watched it and they talked about Frank Milano and they told the story of how Joe Perrello was going to take out a pocket watch out of his pocket. And when he went to take a pocket watch out to check the time, the boys from the Mayfield Road mob thought that he was taking out a gun. And they ended up shooting and killing him. And who knows? Who knows if that's true? Who knows if it was really a case of mistaken identity between a gat and a pocket watch? Or if they planned to kill him from the moment he walked into that place? Who knows? But at the end of the day, Joe Perrello was killed at this Venetian restaurant. What never clicked for me before I sat down and watched Sugar Wars was that it was Frank Bolano's Venetian restaurant. That hit, the killing of Joe Perrello, is what prompted the IRS to step in, seize Milano's books, and start going after him for tax evasion. Because that really is like the end-all be-all charge when nothing else that they come at you with will stick. They'll just come at you for tax evasion. And usually you have to do something really bad to make them stoop to that level. And that's why, because Joe Perrello was killed at Frank Milano's Venetian restaurant and that pissed them off enough to go after him for tax evasion. So yeah, Milano is run out of Cleveland because of a tax evasion charge. But really, it was because Perrello was killed at a restaurant that he owned and police are pissed. Which just, again, made all the puzzle pieces fall into place for me because it wasn't just a peripheral thing that happened where cops were just out for blood for the leader of the Mayfield Road mob for no good reason at all. It was because he owned this restaurant that Joe Perrello was killed at. Now, we all know that Angelo Leonardo was a snitch. Everybody knows that. That's well-known knowledge. But did you know that you can find word for word his entire testimony with a Google search? Yes, ladies and gentlemen, you can read every single word spoken and disclosed by the late, great Angelo Leonardo anywhere you want. But do you want to? Probably not. It's pages and pages and pages of testimony. Altogether, the court transcript with his testimony is 1,261 pages long. Also, I do kind of want to step in here real quick and talk about the fact that Angelo Leonardo lived a whole ass life before he ratted. He ratted when he was 77 years old, which means that he lived his entire life up to 77 in the mafia without snitching. Not once. He didn't open his mouth one time. And that is the hard thing about informants, because once they flip, they're viewed as their entire life having been lived as an informant. But this boy got a life sentence at 19 years old, and he didn't flip. It wasn't until way later in his life, when he was seemingly at the end of his life, that he decided to become an informant. I even looked into it and I was like, maybe it was like a Sammy the Bull type of situation. Like, did they order a hit on him and he decided to flip because they were going to kill him anyway? Was ratting retribution? I couldn't find anything that would suggest that. And the more and more I look into it, the more I don't think it had anything to do with that. I think Angelo just spent his entire life not willing to go to jail.
Did you experience any kind of fallout when Big Ange decided to cooperate with the government?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, especially at the beginning, you have to understand, again, my dad went to law school to defend Big Ange, his uncle. You know, this is my job. This is my whole reason for being. And we're going to close the office. We're going to focus strictly on this. We're going to keep the office alive out of our own pocket. We're not taking on any clients. One client, one job, one goal to prove his innocence. So all of that is set up. And it wasn't until my uncle sat in the courtroom and the prosecution stood up and said, are you going to turn state's evidence? My dad never knew anything about that. Nobody knew anything about that. That was a behind-the-scenes, backdoor deal that he was looking... My uncle was looking at two consecutive life sentences. My dad even sat down with him years after the fact, looked right at him, and said, you killed your brother by what you did. Told Big Ange, you killed your brother by what you did. And he's like, I love my brother. I would do anything for my family. I wasn't going to do two life sentences.
So that was his only reason for cooperating, was that he didn't want to do such a long sentence?
No. They wanted him to, he had two consecutive life sentences he was looking at, followed by additional charges, additional evidence that they had where it would implicate, which angle are you taking? Are you going to get on a stand? Big Angie's like, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to rat on anybody, but I'm going to tell you certain things. So it's going to be conceived as ratting, but I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to get what I want, and I'm not going to spend one night in jail.
So do you have any idea what the fallout from Big Ange's testimony was? Like, do you know how many people ended up in jail based on his testimony or anything like that?
Quite a few. Definitely quite a few. At that point, we were more heartbroken and disgusted.
When he was 19 years old and he was sentenced to life, he was at the very beginning of his appeals process when he succeeded and got out of jail. But at this point, I feel like if he had exhausted all avenues and it looked like this boy was really going to spend the rest of his life in jail, I kind of think he would have flipped back then, honestly. We're going to talk later on about everything that happened that led up to him being arrested and given two consecutive life sentences. But let's talk here for a minute about what led to him actually flipping. First off, it looks like a huge part of him flipping was that he didn't feel that what he was being sentenced for was true. Apparently, the Cleveland family had started working with drug dealers in the days leading up to his final arrest. And a lot of that was outside of Big Ange's hands. According to Big Ange, he told his people like Joey Gallo and Tommy Sanito, not to get into drugs. Don't do it. Don't deal it. Stay away from it. Which does make sense because I know nowadays the mafia is kind of more into drug dealing, especially in more modern days. But you do got to think that Big Ange, even if he was arrested during those days, he did hail from the days of Big Joe Lunardo. He grew up in a very anti-drug atmosphere. So it does make sense that he would tell people, don't do drugs, don't get involved in drugs. You have to think that Big Joe had 17 or 18 years to drill into this boy's skull what to do and what not to do. And for 17 or 18 years, Big Joe was definitely in his ear, like, do not ever, 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 ever even look towards drugs. So it does make sense that he would go out and say, no, stay away.
Drugs are bad, okay?
The collaboration with drug dealers was just one thing among many that ended up taking the Cleveland Mafia down. They would end up doing the same kind of stuff that Mafia members all over the country would do. They would set up drug deals, and then they would end up killing the person that was selling them the drugs, which led to them keeping the drugs and the money and increasing the heat tenfold. Can we think of any other gangster that got caught up in a plot like this and had everything get ruined because of it? I'll give you a hint. It was a Colombian drug cartel leader's baby mama that was killed. No guesses? Okay. Well, it was Roy DeMeo and his crew who set up a drug deal with the cartel. The connection, El Negro, sent a group of his closest confidants, including his bodyguard slash cousin, baby mama, and best friend, to go facilitate this gigantic drug deal. And when they got there, the entire crew was immediately killed. That situation right there is what led to DeMeo's prodigy, Chris, being taken out because the cartel threatened open warfare. And it's also what led to Roy DeMeo chasing down a 19-year-old vacuum salesman who was just like going to school and selling vacuums, doing absolutely nothing wrong, chasing this boy down in broad daylight and killing him. That is a crazy ass story right there. You want to hear some crazy ass shit? Go watch the Roy DeMeo video that I made. Unless you're squeamish, because that shit will make you puke. Way too much, like, blood and guts and gore and shit. So if you're squeamish and you don't like that kind of stuff, pass on that one. But definitely a crazy story. So if you're interested, go check that one out. That one's wild. The testimony of Big Ange starts off with the sentence, "My name is Angelo Leonardo. I am 77 years old, and I am a member of La Cosa Nostra. I am the former underboss of the Cleveland organized crime family. I became a member of La Cosa Nostra in the late 1940s, but have been associated with the organization since the late 1920s. After that, he starts talking about the process of becoming a made man in La Cosa Nostra, and that is a story in itself. I'm going to wrap up part two here, and you're just going to have to tune in next week to hear all about Big Ange's testimony. Thanks so much for watching, and if you're still watching now because this is a really long episode, you're a real one. I hope you guys are enjoying this series about Big Ange. Please let me know in the comments if you're enjoying it and if you want to hear more and more and more, because I have so much. Please don't forget to like, share, subscribe, follow, comment, do all the things, and I'll see you next week. Bye!